What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to IRL podcast. I don't even know what episode is this, 16? When was the last time we did an IRL podcast? I should have looked this up beforehand, but I also want to change the name of this podcast so that it is no longer called the IRL podcast.
I'm gonna be completely honest with you. I do not know.
Oh, when was okay, this is episode 17. Episode 16 was last month, and we talked about The Mandalorian season 2. So this is episode 17 of the IRL cast. I very much want to change the name of this podcast. I think we can be honest with ourselves now. It's just a Star Wars podcast. It's probably going to continue to be a Star Wars podcast.
At least for a while here, yeah.
Because I just love talking about Star Wars, honestly. And it seems like we're going to have a lot of Star Wars content upcoming. So we got to come up with a name. You know what I was thinking of the other day? What was calling it That's No Moon.
Ha
I thought that'd be a good name for it because we could say like That's No Moon, a massive breakdown Star Wars podcast or something like that. You know what I'm saying? I think that's a good name for it, but we'll think
I
about it.
like
We'll
it
come up
I
with
like that
something.
a lot, actually.
Oh boy. All right, guys. Thank you for joining us on That's No Moon podcast, episode one. Or I guess do we have to pick up the numbering where we left off from the IRL cast so people don't get confused? Or do we have to go back and do we have to rename all of them?
I think we have to go back and rename all of them. This actually technically right should be episode 3 because we're talking, of course, about A New Hope. So I
A
feel
New
like we should
Hope.
just rewrite the numbering scheme.
Shouldn't it be episode 4 because it's A New Hope, not
Oh
episode 3?
shoot. Wow, I can't
Yeah.
count. I have started drinking.
So have I. What are you drinking tonight, Kutch? We gotta tell the people what we're drinking.
So I'm drinking Carbach Brewing Company's Brew Sanity Golden Strong Ale. It's insanely delicious, unbelievable, and 8.5% alcohol by volume.
That sounds fantastic. And for the crowd, I am drinking a Shaw Pinot Noir. It was $3 at Trader Joe's. I actually did not realize before we started recording that I was out of beer and out of whiskey. A sad day in the Mercury's household. So I have wine tonight, which, we'll see how that goes. But drinking is drinking, right?
It all counts. It all goes the same place. So
All right, we don't really ever do housekeeping for the That's No Moon podcast, but we do want to shout out thank you to all the patrons. The patrons are the ones who hit the stretch goals that made this podcast possible. They are the reason why we do a podcast every month. So shout out to all the patrons. Thank you guys for that. And like Kutch said, we're going to be talking about A New Hope. So I have probably seen A New Hope, oh God, 10 times, right? 10 times. But it's actually one of the movies I've seen recently, not very often, right? So much so that I actually went back and watched it just last week when I had a couple of buddies over and we were drinking on I think Saturday night or something, and I just watched it again because I wanted to refresh my memory, and all it did was remind me how much I love this movie.
yeah, I have seen. I just think of it as like Star Wars, right? Because growing up as a kid, like this was just Star Wars to me. And then the other ones, they had their titles, right? But this was the original. This was the first. I've seen A New Hope probably in excess of 20 times over the course of my life. I honestly couldn't even begin to count because we watched Star Wars so much as kids. I got in trouble with a babysitter for watching it because Princess Leia wore, an
Yeah.
inappropriate garment in Return of the Jedi. And I was just like, I don't know what you're talking about. I was like 9. So all I knew was that she was about to kill Jabba. And I was just like, this was like the best scene of the movie. I was so excited. So I was super pumped. I was super bummed I didn't get to finish Return of the Jedi that day, but I've seen like this or the original trilogy so many times. We had watched it broadcast on television. We had recorded it illegally
Pirates, pirates.
using VHS tapes. We watched these VHS tapes like a lot. My parents eventually bought the full thing, and we watched those because I think we had probably like watched it so much that we had like damaged them because we were
So
children.
did you have the VHSs that were in the gold three wide like
Yes.
VHS box? That's what I had as well.
We still have those. My parents do.
Really?
Still have I'm jealous
of that. You know, those are pretty expensive now. To, like, buy those online. It's, like, pretty expensive.
I don't think they're in very good shape, but we definitely still have them. They got watched quite a bit. Like, I mean, because my whole family was into it. Like, my whole family was into Star Trek, and we were all into Star Wars. So anytime we wanted to watch these, like, it wasn't even really, like, it was just like, can I watch TV? Okay, I'm watching Star Wars. Like, it was no big deal. So this for me carries, like, so much nostalgia that it's almost hard for me to talk about it without simply stating up front that, like, I see the entire movie every time through rose-tinted glasses. And I'm kind of okay with it.
So, it was a similar thing for my childhood. Like, my dad loved this movie. And so I watched this movie with my dad when I was very, very young. I have nothing but love in my heart for this movie. However, that being said, I ranked the Star Wars movies the other day, and this one's like middle of the road for me in terms of ranking them, because it gets a lot of passes movie-wise because it was the first of the series.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are a lot of things that you know, you watch it and you can see some of the time, like, there were a lot of difficulties in production in this movie, right? There were a lot of issues with the writing, there were issues with the story, with the editing, with the stuff like that, and it gets mostly covered up because of the fact that it's just such a fun movie in general, right? However, when I look at, like, Empire Strikes Back and I look at Return of the Jedi, like, those two movies are, in my opinion, just, like, flat out, like, better movies than A New Hope is. But because New Hope is the original, it just, like, has something special to it that, like, you hand wave away a lot of that stuff because you're like, you know, like, it was the first movie, right? Like, of course they're going to make some things weird in the first movie. But what's so impressive about it to me is that, like, so many tropes that we take for granted now and, like, space westerns and sci-fi and fantasy originated, like, in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, so many quotes that you hear came from this movie. Like, when I rewatched it for the first time in the modern era, you know, a few years back before the new Star Wars movie started coming out, I wanted to keep up. I watched it with one of my buddies, and I remember thinking, like, oh my God, I had forgotten how many sci-fi tropes originated in this movie. Like, people draw on this movie so much. It is such a legendary movie. But I watched it again the last week, and I enjoyed every single minute of it just as much as every time I've watched it, which, you know, like you said, is a ton of times. I love this movie so much. And I'm so excited that we're finally doing the originals, because somehow, I don't know how, we missed out on this. Despite the fact that we're doing a Star Wars podcast, we had never done the originals for an episode.
Yeah. Like, on the one hand, it's like a glaring omission. But on the other hand, it's also almost, like, I feel like they're almost, like, intimidating to take on as a topic. Because they are, like, genre-defining. And they've been impactful for so many people. Like, my mom saw this movie in theaters. Waited in line for hours to get in to see this. Like, this is like, you know, like, just to drop the first of many trivia facts of the day. This was one of the first 25 films selected by the U.S. Library of Congress for preservation in the National Film Registry for being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Think about that. 1989. They've established a National Film Registry. They pick 25 movies from all the movies that have been made to that point. Star Wars is one of those movies. Like, that, even in 1989, they knew that this was, like, the, like, a turning point. This was, like, the dawning of, like, a whole new, like, I don't even know what to say that it is. Like, it's a whole new thing in American culture. You know, in a lot of ways, like, Destiny probably owes a lot to Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
For making sci-fi, like, mass media powerhouse popular. There was popular science fiction before Star Wars, but Star Wars was on a whole other level. Adjusting for inflation, it's the fourth highest grossing film in the world.
And it deserves it.
Like, I mean, it's nuts. It's nuts how much impact this movie had and continues to have, and how much emotion is tied up in it. So it's intimidating to like say, okay, we're gonna talk about it for an episode. And these are our opinions, and there's probably gonna be people who like just disagree with us about things, and that's just fine. That's we're used to that.
The only way you could disagree with us is if for some reason you don't like this movie, because all I'm going to talk about is how much I love this movie in every single scene. But yeah. So, I mean, we should start at the beginning. Although we could take a page out of George Lucas's book and start in the middle with episode four.
As we should.
Yeah. No. Let's do it in a way that actually makes sense. Yeah. Oh, wait. That's can't use our catchphrase so early on. Excuse me. We have to save it for special occasions. Okay, so obviously at the beginning of the movie starts with the iconic crawl of text. It is a period of civil war. Rebel spaceships striking from a hidden base have won their first victory against the evil Galactic Empire. During the battle, Rebel spies manage to seal secret plans of the Empire's ultimate weapon, the Death Star, an armored space station with enough power to destroy an entire planet. Pursued by the Empire's sinister agent, Princess Leia races home aboard her starship, custodian of the stolen plans that can save her people and restore freedom to the galaxy. Awesome, epic opening title crawl. Tells you almost nothing, but at the same time, sets the stage so incredibly well for all of this. And plus, they made that entire title crawl basically into Rogue One, which is one of my favorite Star Wars movies ever. So it's like, you know, it's a perfect way to start. You start basically in media res, or it was in media res. Is that what it is when you start in the middle of the action?
Yeah.
But you've got the Tantive IV, which is an awesome ship, by the way. The Tantive IV is Bail Organa's ship.
Very similar to the original designs, I believe, of the Millennium Falcon. Way, way, way back in pre-production, long before it had its current iconic appearance.
So they reused the asset, basically. They were like, we were going to originally make this the Millennium Falcon, but let's use it for this anyways.
Yeah.
So you've got the Tantive IV pursued by the Imperial Star Destroyer Devastator.
Ooh.
Over the desert planet of Tatooine. Yeah, so there actually is a name of the Star Destroyers. That's the wonderful thing about reading this stuff on Wikipedia, is that, like, I don't think anywhere in the movie does it say that the name of the Star Destroyer was Devastator, but probably in the book that they wrote afterwards it did.
It's probably, like, printed on the side of the ship, and if you just enhanced enough, you could see it.
Yeah, of course. So they catch a tractor beam, Imperial Stormtroopers board the ship. They kill a small number of guards. Interestingly, the captain that Vader chokes and interrogates is actually Captain Antilles, but not the Wedge Antilles that we all know. It is Captain Ramus Antilles.
Mm.
So I did not realize this until literally I was reading this article. So I don't know if Ramus Antilles is like the father of Wedge Antilles or the brother of Wedge Antilles, or
could be no relation. Something.
Yeah,
maybe Antilles is a common name. Common,
yeah, last name. But obviously, Vader unsuccessfully figures out where the plans are, or does not figure out where the plans are, and just kills Antilles and tosses him to the side. And then they get Leia, they capture Leia. Leia records a holographic message. Now, iconic holographic message. Everything about this movie is iconic, is really what it comes down to. But sends it, puts it inside of R2-D2, and the R2-D2 and C-3PO escape. The Empire notices the escape pod jettison, but senses no life in it with their scans, and so does not destroy it. Which, one of my favorite parts, if you've ever watched Blue Harvest, which is the Family Guy version of Star Wars, the escape pod gets jettisoned, and the guy's like, there's no life signs in it, sir, let it go. And the guy's like, what are we, paying by the laser? Like, why would we not just shoot it? And the guy doesn't have an answer for it. And I always thought that was really funny. Like, they should just blow it up. Like, there's no reason for them not to blow it up, but they don't, so.
I think... The Empire has been engaged basically in war for a very long time at this point. And so I suspect that they were in fact paying by the laser. You know, like it takes money to power those reactors, to charge those turbo laser battery banks.
Mm-hmm.
You're paying these people to shoot. They're probably getting some kind of combat bonus.
Yeah, so basically the Empire is a private equity group that is very cost conscious.
I think so.
And yeah, and is motivated by performance.
You can tell in the way that they recruit stormtroopers that they are not paying a premium.
Right. And so what's actually happening is they knew that they were going to be embarrassed. If they had tried to shoot it out of the sky, they would have all missed.
Yes.
Right. And they would have wasted a bunch of lasers, and that's why they didn't do it. So
he's just trying to keep his monthly budget report within bounds so he can look good and get promoted, but not promoted enough to hang out with Darth Vader. That's the mistake, right? Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And so at this point in time, we've gone through a few minutes of the movie. The people we've seen are Princess Leia and the droids, right? Originally, there were some deleted scenes that got cut out of this. So the first draft of... There's going to be a lot of trivia about A New Hope in this episode. We have a lot of trivia. Also, I watched the Empire of Dreams documentary, which talks about the original making or the making of the original trilogy. Fantastic. Highly recommend everyone watch it. It is on Disney Plus. It is one of the best documentaries I've ever seen, and it really shows you a lot about how difficult the production of Star Wars was. In particular, the first Star Wars was exceedingly difficult. Almost everyone thought it was going to flop. There was an early cut of Star Wars that was shown to some of George Lucas's friends that was cut by the original editor. And it was quite bad, right? Really, really, really bad. The only person who thought anything of it was Steven Spielberg, who said it was going to be great. Even George Lucas himself thought it was going to be terrible. Based off the original cut. And in the original cut, there was actually a bunch of scenes. We met Luke super early on. Like, right after the initial space battle, we go down to Tatooine and we see Luke looking up at the sky through a pair of binoculars, and he's able to see the ships out of the atmosphere actually battling, vaguely see them, which is weird. And he hops in his speeder and he goes to Anchorhead.
Future binoculars.
Binoculars, right, yeah. He goes to Anchorhead and he meets a bunch of his buddies in Anchorhead. Anchorhead is the city. And he goes to like a bar or a hangout spot called Toshi Station, and he meets a bunch of his buddies there, and they like chat about the space battle that's happening, and his friends all make fun of him because by the time they get outside, the space battle is done. And then he has a long conversation with Biggs Darklighter, who's his buddy, that Biggs is telling him, like, I've decided to drop out of the academy. I'm going to join the rebellion. Like, I'm going to be a pilot. And like, there's this whole like stereotypical teenager with teenage friends like feeling to all these scenes, and they just, number one, they thought it threw the pacing entirely off, so they ended up cutting all those scenes. The original editor left and they brought in some other editors, and actually George Lucas's wife helped edit it. They brought in some other editors, but they said the first version was just terrible. They said the pacing was horrible. There was a ridiculous amount of unnecessary exposition. Like, there was no tension at all. They said what the scene did is dropping out of the space battle and showing Luke talking with his friends completely killed the tension of like the space battle scene, like completely killed it. So they ended up cutting all those scenes, which is great in my opinion, because it means so much more to see this character Luke and not know about his backstory and not know about his friends and not know about his like angsty teenage problems until after this whole battle. And we've seen these like consequences happening above him. Right. And what George Lucas said is what he actually wanted to do is he wanted to focus on the story of the droids.
Yeah.
At the beginning and not focus on the story of Luke. And I think that that was a brilliant decision. And I think the movie is stronger for it.
I think that was a decision that he had made during the script writing process, that he wanted to both begin and end with the droids. It was important that they were there throughout, because there was actually there was a point where he was stuck and he was trying to, like, he felt like a main character needed to be killed off in order to sort of like push Luke into beginning his hero's journey. And, I guess his wife had actually suggested C-3PO first, but Lucas was, you know, George was like, no, the droids need to be there at the end. And, you know, We'll talk about, obviously, I'm not spoiling anything or saving any spoilers, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that when we get to that.
Someone dies, though.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, anyways, the droids make it down onto the planet Tatooine. They decide to go their separate ways. As we all know, they get captured by Jawas, brought before Luke and his uncle Uncle Owen.
Who hasn't been captured farmers. By Jawas? You know, it's yeah, just...
it happens to everyone. It happens to the best of us. But we brought there. Before, brought before Uncle Owen. Uncle Owen tries to buy one of the droids. I think it's, is it R5 or something? He tries to buy one of the droids, yeah. And the droid blows a fuse, basically.
It's got a bad actuator.
Bad actuator. Same droid shows up in Mandalorian.
Common problem.
On Tatooine, at the hangar that that Mando parks... parks his ship in, and I love that scene, by the way. So they end up going with C-3PO, and C-3PO convinces them to take R2-D2 as well. We get to see Luke in his natural habitat as a teenager who feels stifled by his uncle not letting him leave, still working on the moisture farm, right? And so he gets assigned to go clean up the droids, basically give him a nice oil bath. Which is pretty neat that they've got that. And then we get some chatter about Luke wants to go and join the academy. How funny is that he's trying to go join the Imperial Academy to be a pilot?
Yeah.
Like his buddy Biggs did. Of course, had that scene not been deleted, we would have known that Biggs is planning to drop out of the academy and join the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the scene with Uncle Owen is interesting. Obviously, those characters got assigned more gravitas in the prequels when you actually see who they are and you see how he's related to them, right? But you know, for the most part, we're not really in too deep yet. What happens is R2 leaves, starts to wander through the desert. Luke goes after him with C-3PO, foolishly gets attacked by a sand person and gets knocked out. Which the scene, by the way, where the sand person is shaking the thing over their head. They actually, it's only one up and down, and then they just played it in reverse and forward three times.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, because they actually shot it a lot shorter than that. So a lot of the stuff that you'll see, like the reason the movie is as good as it is because the editors did a fantastic job. Like they completely changed the pacing and the cuts from how it was. Like originally they said, and this is from Empire Dreams, they said that if you had watched the original cut, they would like... trail off, like the character would finish talking and the camera would like linger on the character's face, and then several seconds later it would like fade to another character. And it was like this very slow, methodical editing where it was like every character was like finishing their lines and then waiting and then going on, and it was just like the most boring lack of tension ever. So what they started to do is they were cutting, like, the second a character finished talking, or before that even, they would cut to the next scene, or they would cut in the middle of them talking. And they said that they were basically using the script to determine where they were cutting instead of using the actors. So the original editor, the actor would finish talking, and then the actor would, like, you know, do something with their face. Like, they'd finish talking, and they'd, like, you know, turn their head or look something. And so the original editor was using the actor's cues to determine when to change. And they said, screw that. We don't care what the actor's doing. Like, we'll cut away from the actor in the middle of them saying something if it feels like a good point in the script to show something else.
Yeah.
Right. And so it gave it like a really fast-paced style of editing. And I think that's what made it, you know, so much better than it ended up being. And they were able to pull a lot of tricks and a lot of stuff that, like, scenes that had been shot badly, they were able to use and make them into a good scene.
It just goes to show how valuable good editing is in film. I mean, you honestly almost can't put a price on it.
I think editing is perhaps the most important part of film, because even with a relatively wooden script, which, let's be honest here, the script isn't tremendously great, right? Like, it's not a groundbreaking script or anything like that. The script isn't tremendously great, right? With good editing, it makes a great movie. And I think the same thing could be said when we talked about the sequels and how much we didn't like some of the stuff in the sequels. Like, good editing could have saved The Last Jedi. Yeah. Good editing could have saved Rise of Skywalker. Like, bad editing was part of what made those movies as bad as they are. We wasted so much time in Last Jedi because they could have edited a scene out that served no purpose in the overall, like, literally no purpose in story progression, right? We could have edited that entire scene out. Movie would have been 30 minutes shorter, a lot faster paced, would have made more sense, right? Same thing with Rise of Skywalker. It was super choppy editing, and they jumped from point to point to point to point to point, and the movie was too short, right? Like,
yeah.
Bad editing can kill a movie. And unfortunately, I feel like I truly believe this, and I just dropped my phone, which is what that loud noise was. I truly believe that someone could go in and take The Last Jedi and with just editing, maybe taking some of the deleted scenes that are finished and putting them back in, with just editing, could probably make a 2-hour movie that's a pretty darn good Star Wars movie. You can't really do that with Rise of Skywalker because of the stuff that was cut out as opposed to too much that was left in. But I believe that you probably could do that with Last Jedi.
I think at the very least, it would be a much better Star Wars movie. A lot of the issues I have in that movie are dialogue and like are intrinsic to the plot where I don't think they could have gotten around with them. But to sort of circle back, I mean, editing very much is the difference between an okay movie and a great movie, and a terrible movie and an okay movie. Like, if The Last Jedi could have just gotten to okay, I would be probably fine with it.
And the thing is, if The Last Jedi could have just gotten to okay, Rise of Skywalker probably would have been better.
It would have.
Because
yeah.
Rise of Skywalker wasted so much time trying to undo stuff that had happened in The Last Jedi that it ended up shooting itself in the foot. And, you know. Anyways.
A New Hope, phenomenal yeah. editing.
And it also helped that George Lucas had a somewhat unified vision. It was his vision. He had a somewhat unified vision for what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
Like, there were certain scenes that he added in, like the scene of Darth Vader spinning away in the TIE fighter after he gets struck by the TIE pilot that panics when Han Solo starts shooting them down. Nobody wanted that in the movie except for him. Because everybody was like, oh, it's cheesy. It sets up a sequel. And at that point in time, sequels weren't considered, you know, a good idea. Most sequels had been terrible. And he said, no, we have to put it in the movie. Because it is going to lead into something else, right? Like, he had that confidence. Anyways, the long and short of it is that Luke gets captured by a sand person, and then Obi-Wan comes in and fakes the sound of a crate dragon. Is actually what that roar is that he does is a crate dragon, and then says the iconic line: "The sand people are easily startled, but they'll be back and in greater numbers."
Yeah,
and takes Luke back to his house, and then just out of nowhere is like, "Yeah, man, your father was a Jedi. Here's his lightsaber. Like, let's do this thing." Like, he's just like, "It's time. You were seeking me out and you found me, or I found you. It's time to go. It's time to rock and roll. Like, I've been watching you literally your entire life. They're going to make a Obi-Wan series on Disney Plus about this time period. Let's do this thing."
I'm kind of excited to see Obi-Wan like secretly saving a young Luke, like 3-4 dozen times from some kind of Imperial disaster.
From afar and stuff like that.
It's going to be like a Jedi spy series is like what I'm picturing. I don't know what they're really going to do. Obviously, I have no inside information, but I'm almost picturing like it's going to be a Jedi spy series where he has to remain hidden. Like, I'm super pumped. Anyway.
And it's going to be Ewan McGregor, who.
Yeah.
That's going to be awesome. So anyways, they they basically have to go to Mos Eisley, the most wretched hum of Skyven villainy. Because they need to find a pilot who can take them to Alderaan, because the droid, the message from Leia, was, "Help me, Obi-Wan, you're my only hope. But basically, you served my father, Bail Organa, in the Clone Wars, and he's calling to you now. He knows that you've survived, and he needs you to come help, and it's been a long time." And so they have to go to Mos Eisley to find a ship to take them to Alderaan. And of course, that's where they meet Han Solo and his first mate, a Wookiee named Chewbacca. And Han Solo agrees to take them to Alderaan for 17,000 credits, a lot of credits, in the Millennium Falcon. And before they can leave, he meets Greedo. And
one way or another, all we know is that Greedo ends up dead.
Yeah, in the original movie, Han shot first.
He did.
At a later point in time, Greedo shot first. In the current version, they shoot simultaneously and Greedo missed, but before he shoots, he says McClunky, which is not even subtitled at the bottom. It's just some random nonsense word, which I don't know why he does that, but...
So I think this is one of my few pet peeves, at least with the modern versions. I liked the original. As a kid, it did not deter me from liking Han Solo that he killed Greedo in cold blood.
No, Greedo was going to kill him. That's literally what he was there for.
It was very clear that Greedo was threatening him.
Right.
And that he acted preemptively in a dangerous situation. It made Han cool. It made him seem competent and impulsive and effective as a sort of a criminal slash hero. And just messing with it after the fact, like, it's the hardest thing in the world for somebody to be done with, like, something that they've created. And the great, like, the great virtue, I think, of publishing deadlines in the past has always been that at a certain point you just have to be done with it. And sometimes that's for the best, because you can always keep making changes, but those changes aren't always going to be better. And especially when you have too much time to think about things, you start to overthink them. You start to overanalyze them in a way that is just not productive. When you have a deadline, you're forced to make a decision and to commit. And they made the decision and they committed, and then later he wants to change it. And it's like, you just got to live with it.
I will say this.
On shot first, man.
I will say this. With video games, the video game comes out and then stuff gets changed after the fact, like patching it, right?
Sure.
I think George Lucas was the first person to take advantage of the fact that in movies, you can patch the movie, right? There are multiple editions of books that come out too. You can patch the movie and you can change things. I think the mistake he made was changing the wrong things, right? But I actually kind of like the idea of coming back in and saying, that was version one of the movie. Now that I've sat on it for a bit, I don't actually like it. Here's version two. Because would you not like to see a version two of the sequels? Like, legitimately, wouldn't you like to see a version two of the sequels where somebody, be it George Lucas or Dave Filoni, right? Tell me this. Tell me, Dave Filoni takes control of the sequels. Full editing rights, ability to add back in deleted scenes, ability to slightly modify some scenes. Do you not believe that Dave Filoni could make a version of the sequels that would fit into the current canon and would also be an exceptional Star Wars movie? And we could wipe out the shitty version of The Last Jedi and the shitty version of Rise of Skywalker. We could wipe those out of existence. It sucks when they do it to a masterpiece, but at the same time, like, I was not satisfied with the sequels. And that's a bummer because I love Star Wars and I feel like I'm missing a chunk of the canon in terms of what I enjoy rewatching. I would love to see someone go back in and fix those movies and have it be official.
I'll give you that. When somebody has really flopped, I think making sweeping changes even, I have no problem with. I guess a big part of the problem I have here is that this was not a flop. This was a movie that is arguably among the most beloved movies of all time for the human race. Like, among the movie-watching populace of this planet. And to go back and, like, retcon even mistakes, I think, is incredibly dangerous. Like, I really think you have to look at, okay, how many people is this going to impact in a potentially negative way? I feel like he just didn't... I feel like all he cared about was trying to get some vision across.
Yeah, but, you know, some of it too, like, so he did one original retcon, and then he did a second retcon where he added in some CGI stuff when they were testing CGI things for the Phantom Menace, right?
Sure.
They were using ILM and they were using it as a base, but I didn't mind those changes. I didn't necessarily think they looked good, but it didn't hurt the story to me. It didn't detract anything from the story, and it didn't change the story in any way. Even the scene with Jabba the Hutt, which was originally a scene they shot, and Jabba was a human, there was a stand-in, and they couldn't find a way to make the puppet work in the scene, so they ended up just dropping the entire scene, right? But it was originally shot, and it was originally intended to be in the movie. Jabba's, you know, language is in there and everything. All they did was they CGI'd Jabba back over. It's weird to me, but I don't necessarily dislike it, right? I feel like it's seeing a deleted scene added back in, and I kind of like that.
I think that's fundamentally different from what he did in the scene with Greedo.
I agree with that.
Because there he's adding something that arguably doesn't necessarily add anything to the plot, but doesn't necessarily detract anything from the plot. Either way, we already know that Jabba is gunning for Han, that Han owes Jabba money, a lot of money. And that's you know, ultimately, like, all we really need, like, the scene with Greedo really, really told us all the information that the second scene with Jabba tells us. So I'm, you know, that scene, it was short. It didn't detract from the movie, so I was fine with it.
I liked it because we saw the bounty hunters. We saw the bounty hunters again. We saw Boba Fett again.
Yeah.
Like, I liked that scene a lot, and I'm glad that they added it back in. But, you know, it's stuff like that. Like, I like to see revisions to the movies that I feel like add to the universe. But I agree with you that the Greedo scene with Han definitely changes Han's character in a way that was unnecessary.
Yeah, I think it's once a like changing who a character is and what they will do, I think is a big change. You know, giving us a scene that maybe gives us some more information, some new information about the character, that's one thing. Changing a scene that, in a way, where you're trying to, like, change our image of a character, I don't know. I mean, I feel like that was a mistake. But that's neither here nor there, and we're, like, 35 minutes into the episode, and, like, not even that far into the movie.
It's fine. It's a wonderful movie. So they get back. They get up into space. They get to Alderaan. Turns out Alderaan's not there. Just a lot of rubble. Because, because Grand Moff Tarkin has destroyed Leia's home planet. Even though she told him where the rebel cell was going to be hidden, turns out she lied to him, which is good. And... It's a fantastic scene. I love the scene where they destroy Alderaan. But they get there. A TIE fighter appears, and they question how a TIE fighter could be there, because they're like, TIE fighters don't have hyperdrives. They can't get this far out away from everything. And they're like, maybe it's flying back towards that small moon. That's no moon.
That's no moon.
That's no moon. And so they get caught in the tractor beam. They make the very brilliant decision to hide. They actually turn this thing wildly around from what could have happened, which is them getting captured. They all hide inside the ship. They lure some stormtroopers inside, knock them out, put on their clothes. God knows what they did with the bodies, right?
I mean, the bodies are still just in the Millennium Falcon somewhere. I assume put them in the smuggling compartments, and they're still there to this day.
Yeah, those are the skeletons that Rey found in the sequels. But, So they put on the stormtrooper outfits, and then they pretend that the Wookiee is their prisoner, and they realize that they're going to go try to free Princess Leia. Not a very well thought out plan, but a plan nonetheless. One of the favorite things about this, I think everybody loves it, is the scene where they break into the cell block and they shoot everyone down, and then they get a call on the radio, and Han responds back on the radio. I was like, no, everything's fine here. How are you doing? Turns out that scene, he just improvised it. He didn't even bother to learn his lines. He wanted to sound realistic, which it does. So he just made up some lines talking on the radio, and turns into one of the most iconic one of the most humorous scenes in the entire original trilogy.
Yeah, it's like, no, we're all fine down here. How are you?
Yeah. And then boring conversation anyway. It shoots the thing. They find Leia. Leia insults. This is what. So one of the things that I never understood about the sequels is that people were like, the sequels had too much humor in them. The original trilogy didn't have humor. It's like, are you kidding me? The original trilogy had a ton of humor. The first thing Leia says when Luke walks in is, aren't you a little short for a stormtrooper?
Yeah.
Right? Like, there is so much humor in the original series. It may have been a different style of humor, something that could be argued, but there's a ton of humor in the original series.
I think the problem with the humor in the prequels was that there was a lot of slapstick added, which was not...
I didn't even honestly mind it. It's for kids, and slapstick was big at that point in time, right? Slapstick wasn't as big in the 70s, I don't think, or maybe it was. I wasn't alive in the 70s, so
yeah.
I don't know what type of...
Who can say?
Yeah. Anyways, so they grab Leia, and they jump into a garbage compactor, basically.
Fun fact about this. Mark Hamill actually held his breath so long in this scene that he burst a blood vessel in one side of his face, and they had to like shoot the rest of the scene and I guess some other scenes so that they were only using one side of his face, because like he literally stayed under, he was that committed, I guess, that he actually burst a blood vessel holding his breath. So one of those things.
Yeah. And then we've got, so they jump into this thing. The part that he burst the blood vessel during the scene was, apparently the creature that's in there is called a Dianoga. And it's like a cephalopod with, instead of like a squid's head, it has like a stalk with an eye on it. which is what pops up and like looks around, and then it has seven tentacles and like a it looks like a sarlacc mouth in between the seven tentacles, and they're actually sentient, which is amazing. This is all obviously added long after this, and some of them were actually sensitive to the Force as well.
Wow.
So an interesting thing. So that's what's in there. It drags Luke under. They just randomly shoot into the water. It lets him go. Obviously, the trash compactor starts to then compact, and R2-D2 luckily shuts it down right before they get crushed. Very wonderful scene. They escape, and Obi-Wan runs into... Obi-Wan has gone and what? He shuts off the tractor beam is what he's gone and done during this time?
Yes.
He's wandered off somewhere and shut off the tractor beam?
So while they've been engaging in... I think what Leia accurately describes as like the worst rescue ever. Obi-Wan has been entirely competent this whole time and just like literally is taking care of business.
What's amazing to me is that, so I will say one thing the prequels did a lot better and the sequels did a lot better than the originals, the lightsaber fighting. And the prequels and in the sequels is fantastic. In the originals, it's like they're tapping each other with sticks, like two old men, like circling around and like tap a stick. And then that's like kind of all they do. And then he just stands there and gets cut down. He says, you know, you can't win, Darth. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine. And then he basically just lets Darth Vader, you know, kill him, but he immediately disappears and becomes one with the Force, right? Becomes one with the Force as Qui-Gon did and as Qui-Gon taught them to do. And then, you know, that allows Luke and them time to escape. Luke sees it, becomes furious, fires off a bunch of blaster shots, and then they run.
I think this is such an important scene to the movie, right? This is what I was talking about earlier. This is the catalyst for Luke to actually become a hero. Because up to this point, he's been a follower, and he defends his Force training to Han. But he's also been rather resistant to Obi-Wan up to that point. So he's clearly kind of on the fence about the whole thing. But at this point, he sees Obi-Wan die. He doesn't know about becoming one with the Force. He doesn't have all of this lore and this backstory. He's literally a moisture farmer from Tatooine as of like, what, 2-3 days prior. And at this point he's like, all right, I'm in. So I think this is so important because we meet the villain. Darth Vader is established as an ominous, threatening force with sort of, nebulous, undefined powers, who in a world of spaceships and blaster rifles wields a laser sword, which just automatically tells you that he's a badass.
He's a badass, yeah.
Like, so... And I think too, like, the dialogue, the back and forth between Obi-Wan and Darth Vader is also as are so many of scenes in this film have become, is this iconic moment of the mentor sacrificing himself in order to set an example for his protege, and sort of snatching victory from defeat at the hands of this Dark Lord, and that it, you know, while he appears to have been slain, he's actually accomplished what he wanted to.
Yeah, which has made it to where he can train Luke for all eternity through the Force and by talking to him.
Yeah, exactly. And it works. Yeah. I mean, it's like you could watch this scene and it happens. It's impactful in the moment, and there's a lot of other things going on. But I feel like this scene sets up so much that happens in the rest of the movie.
You know what would have been better is if George Lucas had gone back and with CGI made Obi-Wan do a couple flips, maybe some tricks, maybe try spinning. You know, that would have really pushed this over the edge, right? Because, I mean, it's a very tame lightsaber fight.
It is.
Compared to other ones. So I'm just saying, you know, a backflip here or there. Maybe throw the lightsaber.
I like to think of it as like it was two master duelists who have faced off before, simply testing each other to determine which of them is going to win this fight.
Right, sure. Because
Lucas was inspired a lot by Kurosawa and samurai movies. And so there were a lot of scenes in there where, like, the master samurai doesn't even have to engage in the fight to know who's going to win. He simply observes his opponent's stance and tension, and he's like, no, I would have killed you.
So that is exactly, and this is going to be spoilers for Rebels, Star Wars Rebels, which means it's actually probably a spoiler for you. If you don't want me to talk about it, I won't. But are you cognizant of what happens to Obi-Wan post, or Obi-Wan and Darth Maul post Clone Wars, like the TV series Clone Wars? Do you know how, like, Darth Maul's story concludes and stuff like that, or do you not?
I don't. Oh, I believe I heard something about, like, droid spider legs at some point, and that's really all I know.
That's much, much earlier. Okay, so I'm not going to spoil it for you then, but I will say that what you just talked about right there, of two masters sizing each other up, is the conclusion to the Obi-Wan Darth Maul saga in the Rebels episode Beneath Twin Suns, which is one of my favorite episodes of all time. And basically, it's two old masters sizing each other up in one of the quickest lightsaber duels that has ever happened, right?
Yeah.
And it's because they both go through so much shifting pre-fight that it only takes one stroke. One person misses, the other person hits, and the fight is over, right? And, like, that's what it is. It's Star Wars Rebels Beneath Twin Suns, one of my favorite episodes ever. There's actually a lot of my favorite Star Wars stuff comes from Rebels, which now that I was looking back and I was, like, ranking all the different arcs, like, Beneath Twin Suns, Twilight of the Apprentice, Jedi Knight, those three, it's actually technically four episodes total, but those four episodes are, I believe, some of the strongest Star Wars stories that have ever happened. So I highly recommend to anyone out there who has not watched Rebels. The first season is a little childish and, like, you know, funny and blah, 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 blah. Like, the first season seems like it's like the prequels, right? From the end of season two until the end of the series, Star Wars Rebels is some of the best storytelling in Star Wars, just flat out.
So, like, I definitely, not to shift subjects, but I just haven't seen it. So I definitely went through a phase where I was definitely kind of a fan of, like, a lot of old, like, black and white samurai movies. And so I've seen a few. And, like, one of the things that I guess that I noticed that I think translates over into Star Wars is that most of the flashy lightsaber fighting where people are being cut down and there's lots of flips and moves and stuff happens in a very unequal fight where a Jedi or a Sith is just cutting people down. Because there's just nothing that the opposition can do about it. Or in a fight against two opponents who just don't know anything about each other prior to encountering each other. And so I feel like that's where the Darth Maul, Qui-Gon, Obi-Wan fight comes in, where they've never fought, they don't really know anything about each other's fighting style, and so there's a lot of feeling each other out, testing and retreating, that happens. And, like, so this fight, to me, it just, you know, as somebody who is not, like, a sword fighting aficionado, but knows just enough to appreciate sword fighting, to me, this makes a lot of sense if you view it from that light, that they both already knew each other's moves. They knew everything the other person could do. And they only needed a few exchanges to determine what has changed. And Obi-Wan knew he could not win. And so why draw it out? Instead, he took a Pyrrhic victory, and he set the scene that he wanted for his defeat. Because Darth wanted to kill him, and he wanted Luke to see it happen. And so they both won. But ultimately, Obi-Wan's victory, of course, was the greater.
Mm-hmm. And you would have to think that, like, it would be pretty traumatizing as Luke to have seen that happen. Like, you've never known anything your entire life except for Tatooine and moisture farming. You finally get an opportunity to meet someone who tells you your father was a Jedi, gives you a lightsaber, tells you that they want you to come explore the galaxy with them and help the rebellion, right? In a couple of days.
Yeah.
You finally start to get attached to this person who also, by the way, was with you when you found out your family had been murdered.
Yeah.
Right? And they feel like they're the only connection that you have left right now. And then you just watch them get cut down before your eyes by the same person who he told you murdered your father.
Yeah.
Right? So Luke's got this whole thing going on right now. Regardless, they leave. They escape a couple TIE fighters. They get to Yavin 4, which is where the Rebel cell actually is, or the Rebel force actually is. And at this point, this is like very close to the strongest the Rebels have ever been at this point in time. They have just gotten the victory at Rogue One. They have finally gotten the plans back to them. They have generals, they have pilots, they have ships. The Mon Calamari are helping, right? Like, this is the strongest the Rebels have been. Everything has built up to this point. And they decide that with the plans they have, the only thing that they can do is they need to attack the Death Star, right? Well, you know, and I forget, there's a bunch of generals in this. There's General Dodonna, I think, is one of them, who's the one that is the old white guy with the beard is Jan Dodonna. Are there a couple other ones? Is Mon Mothma? Is Mon Mothma in this first one, or is she only in Return of the Jedi or whatever it is?
You know, I'm actually, off the top of my head, I'm not 100% sure.
Well, regardless, this is the first glance that we see of the larger rebellion, right? The larger rebellion's there. They decide to attack the Death Star. The Death Star is basically like, you can't attack us if we're going to kill you first, right? And they then have to do the famous trench run, which doesn't go particularly well for some of the initial groups. They try to shoot their torpedoes through the trench, and they just impact on the surface. And then, of course, Luke decides to take his turn. Obi-Wan whispers into his ear, use the Force, Luke. Luke puts away his targeting computer, which they can track at Rebel headquarters.
Yeah.
But he's no longer using his targeting computer. Unfortunately, his buddy Biggs Darklighter is killed by Darth Vader and the pursuing TIE fighters. But out of nowhere, Han Solo comes back after having seemingly abandoned them before, taking his money and running. Han Solo comes back, doesn't shoot Darth Vader because that wouldn't fit in too well with how powerful Darth Vader is supposed to be. Instead, shoots the TIE fighter off of Darth Vader's wing, which panics and crashes into Darth Vader and forces Darth Vader's TIE fighter to lose control and spin off into space.
Which at the time you accept, later you think, oh gosh, if he's so powerful, couldn't he have like avoided this in some way? And then you watch the Clone Wars animated series and you're like, no, this is par for the course for Anakin's piloting.
Yeah, he crashes almost everything he ever flies. Like, he constantly gets into trouble. He constantly, you know, he's the most aggressive and, you know, he's very strong in the Force, but almost everything he flies gets destroyed at some point in time by something or other.
None of it can keep up with him. Let's just
He pursues with incredible aggressiveness, and that leaves him vulnerable to things happening to him because he believes that he is basically invincible.
Yeah.
Which he pretty much is.
Almost.
Close. So, finally, because the hole is no bigger than a Womp Rat, which he used to bullseye all the time back home in his T-13, Luke is able to fire the proton torpedoes into the small exhaust port, and the battle station explodes.
I mean, shoot, if you can bullseye a Womp Rat in your T-13, like, this was child's play. Just saying.
Yeah, this was easy. Force helped him out, too.
NBD.
He used the Force. Yeah.
Yeah.
So a couple of ships remain. Wedge Antilles remains. Luke, Han, a random Y-Wing pilot. And they celebrate. They have this cool little medal ceremony where everyone's standing in, you know, and he's got his yellow jacket on, his iconic yellow jacket, and Leia gives him a medal, and there's some weird sexual tension. Not sure if it's between Leia and Luke, or if it's between Han and Leia, Han and Luke, Han and Chewbacca. We're not really sure. It's just sexual tension all around. And that's it. That's A New Hope. The movie ends right there. Everybody's happy. Everybody's thrilled. We can't wait for the sequel. I love it.
I do too. I mean, one of the great things about A New Hope, one of the things that they did... Honestly, I think that they did right in all of the original trilogy movies that they struggled to recreate in many of the later movies is that they kept the plot simple. They didn't try to weave some complicated plot. This is not a complicated plot movie. This is a very straightforward science fantasy adventure movie. And that's all it has to be. As long as it sticks to that and executes on that vision, which is why A New Hope, I think, captured people in a way that few movies have before or since. Because it was aiming to be one thing, and it just, it was that thing very well. And I think that's a problem when a movie, or when the people making a movie, don't really know what it's trying to be. Or if there's a disconnect between what they think they're making and what people are expecting them to make. Which I think is a big part of the problem with The Last Jedi. We've brought it up before, but for me, I feel like the movie that the director wanted to make and that maybe some people involved with it wanted to make was very different from the movie that Star Wars fans were expecting. And I think that's a big part of the reason that it just didn't work super well for a lot of people.
Yeah. Another thing that he did, which is very, very smart, is that he actually tried very hard to make the movie something that could be enjoyed by people across multiple cultures, multiple nationalities. He tried very hard to make it like culturally agnostic, right? Like what he did, and this is again from Empire of Dreams, he read a bunch of legends from many different cultures, and he took what he considered to be the similar elements from each of those legends and condensed them down into this one super generic but very relatable story, right? Also, the darn thing just changed a ton. If you look on Wikipedia and you watch Empire of Dreams, again, I'm going to pitch Empire of Dreams a million times because it's the most fantastic thing ever. But if you look on Wikipedia and you talk about it, like, the ideas that he had for the story in general were so incredibly different than what we got, which is great because it's cool to see that, like, that evolution, right? But, you know, he wrote the script, and he originally wrote all three movies as one movie, and they told him it was too much for one movie and to cut it down, and he refused. He said, no, I won't do that. He said, I'll just make the first third of it. And, you know, if it's successful, then we'll make the other two later, but I'm not going to condense, I'm not going to crush all this stuff down into a single movie. Like, he, and this is big, and they talk about a lot of Empire Dream, he hated the studio system because his first two movies that he had made had both been edited heavily by the studio without his consent, and he hated it more than anything. So he tried to, he tried everything he could to keep as much power as he could over Star Wars, including for the sequels. He actually self-funded them. He had a studio as a distribution partner, but he actually took out over a $30 million loan from a bank and self-funded the second Star Wars movie because he really didn't want the studio to have any power over the movie at all, right? Which is incredible. But, you know, what ended up happening with him, he actually pitched Star Wars to a number of studios. They all turned it down. Disney turned it down. Who was it? It was Disney turned it down. It was like
ironic United Artists now. Turned
it down. Yeah, I know, because then Disney ends up buying it for a lot more money afterwards. Who was it? It was Universal Studios turned it down. The people who eventually got it were 20th Century Fox, but it wasn't even that they were investing in the movie. It was that they liked Lucas's previous work and they thought Lucas was smart. And they were like, eh, I mean, I don't really understand what he's trying to do, but I think he'll make a good movie, right? And so the guy who was in charge of that was Alan Ladd Jr., and he did that. But what, you know, what Lucas did that was so smart is he negotiated out, he wanted to maintain merchandising rights, right? Like, at the time, that was a joke. Like, nobody cared about merchandising rights. That was nuts. And he wanted to negotiate that out, and, you know, looky there, ended up making millions upon millions of dollars from those merchandising rights because it became such, you know, such a phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, like, interesting stuff, I guess, that sort of beyond the movies that went on here. I don't know, do you want to wrap up with maybe, like, five fun facts each here?
Oh my God, I feel like you're asking me to narrow it down to five fun facts. I could speak for another 6 hours about just like trivia and little things. I mean,
Hey.
guys, what it's gonna have to do is at some point we're gonna have to do one of these for Empire of Dreams. Like we're gonna have to watch Empire of
Yeah.
Dreams, or we're just gonna have to talk about Empire of Dreams. We'll probably do that when we're done with the
I
original
think
trilogy.
so. I think
I
that would
mean,
be a good
'cause
thing to come back and do.
yeah, why don't you go ahead and talk about your favorite five? 'Cause I might not even be able to do it. I might just have to do an entire episode of Star Wars trivia.
I mean, there's so many. So one of the first ones that I really get a kick out of as kind of a space science buff is how the Millennium Falcon made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. Right. So if you hear this line and you know what a parsec is, which I did not when I first saw the movie, but as you know, as an adult, I know what a parsec is. Who doesn't, right? Who doesn't? You're like, I mean, if it's that's an odd boast. Like what exactly is the Kessel Run then? So what it comes down to is that the George Lucas originally thought a parsec was a measurement of time. So he was saying, this is an extremely fast ship, right? That's of course the claim of the Millennium Falcon, right? The fastest ship in the galaxy. Well, a parsec is a measure of distance. It's approximately 3.26 light years. We could get into why that's how far away a parsec is, but it's really not important. The point is, it's a measure of distance, and it's always been a measure of distance. And he was just confused. He just misunderstood what it was measuring. But once written, it was never changed, and it's now canon that Han Solo somehow in the Millennium Falcon managed to make this run in a shorter distance than any other pilot. The Kessel Run, I think, being later defined as an area of black holes that was common for smugglers to use because it was extremely dangerous to make hyperspace jumps through. And so he was able to do it, more recklessly and get away with it in this
He was able
ship.
to shave some distance off of the run,
Yes.
which nobody else could do.
And thus also saving time and lending credence to his claim. But it's just like a weird, like, normally if a trip is a certain distance, how do you do it in less distance? And that's sort of the weirdness of it. So I think that's a fun one. Another one that I think is really pretty wild. It's very real world. It's affected all of us. So once upon a time, when you bought a ticket to go to the movies, you could just sit in that theater and watch whatever movies they were playing until you felt like leaving. But Star Wars was so popular, and they were making so much money selling tickets, and people were sitting there rewatching it so many times and waiting in line to get in, waiting for people to leave, people who had rewatched it 3, 4, 5 times in a row during the day, that theaters actually had to start changing their policies to say, your ticket gets you one viewing. Star Wars did that. So like that's like it's small. It's not, in the grand scheme of the universe, it's not that big a deal, but it's affected every person's movie experience since then. It gets
Good for
that's just
Star Wars.
crazy, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's an easy number two for me. Did you have any you wanted to throw in here?
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk about a couple of them. Oh, Jesus. God, it's so hard to narrow these down. I highly recommend everyone go on IMDb and look at the trivia for this. It's funny
It's
because the
nuts.
trivia is basically just Empire of Dreams, but like typed out into like word form. But some of the ones that I really liked are the fact that George Lucas was supposedly only had like two things that he would ever say when he was directing, And like the cast found him really hard to like take instruction from. He would only say two things, either faster or more intense. And at one point in time, he lost his voice during the shooting, and they just gave him a board with the words faster on the top and more intense on the bottom. And he just pointed at which one he wanted. And that was it. And that was like how he directed them. I mean,
tells you he wanted to make a fast, intense movie.
Right. And the original editing didn't do it justice. In original early drafts, R2-D2 actually could speak English and had like a foul mouth.
This was
and
one of
they removed all of R2's speech and made it beeps, but they left all of C-3PO's reactions to what he says in. So all C-3PO's reactions are as if he's reacting to the English language or the basic things that he was saying. I mean, geez, I'm trying. Oh, I love the one about Harrison Ford. That Harrison Ford was not supposed to actually be in the movie. He was brought in to read lines opposite for the people they were casting for Luke and Leia. And they brought him in and he read all these lines because he'd worked with Lucas before. And then they realized like halfway through the thing, they were like, we can't get anyone else to do this. Like Harrison Ford is Han Solo. Like he has to be this. But he wasn't even supposed to be the one that was going to do it, right? I mean, that's crazy to me.
I think that's super... super cool fact, and like that really, I mean, I say really, but I mean like literally launched Harrison Ford's career in a way that I don't think, like, that might not have happened otherwise. So one other little tidbit that I think is really interesting is Darth Vader's armor. So this intense suit of armor complete with breathing apparatus, right now, of course, in the lore, we know it's because not even lava could stop Anakin's hatred back on Mustafar. So single-minded was he. But the real-world version is because the original script called for Vader to travel back and forth through space between ships. Just like himself. And so the concept artist felt that his costume, his character needed this like full like breathing apparatus and this body armor in order to kind of make that make sense. And they liked the look so much, it was so intimidating, and they just kept it because of that. I just think it's just kind of interesting because, of course, that doesn't happen, you know? So it's this, like you talked about, like there was so much that changed from the original pitch to the movies. And then there's kind of the artifacts that were left over from that.
It's, if I could be, you know, if I could get in a time machine and I could go back and I could see how they filmed the original Star Wars movies, I think that would be absolutely a treat. Absolutely a treat, because you know, it part of it kind of it destroys the magic of seeing how the stuff goes on behind the scenes, but at the same time, part of it to me, that is the magic, right? Like seeing how these things that you love get built. It's why I had so much fun going out and getting to work at Bungie for just a short period of time, because I love Destiny, and seeing how Destiny gets built is just absolutely incredible. And I feel the same way about Star Wars. Like I just wish, you know, I really really wish that I could be a part of this universe and get behind the curtain and see how it goes.
Yeah, it's I would agree. I think when you think about all of the just sort of like unconventional and like time consuming, exhausting things that they had to do, you know, just making like models and filming models up close, and all of the things that they had to do to make this movie, and then you look at the finished product. And they're so far removed that there is a kind of magic in how they went from one to the other. And how they went from just like a model, like a flat surface model, and then you've got spaceships flying over the surface of the Death Star. It's like, but it's only a model. But you see the movie and it's like, no, it's real. It is magic.
Space magic is what it is.
It is, and I think this movie is magic. And I think that maybe is where we wrap up for the day.
Oh, I guess we gotta call it. It's a shame that we can't just talk about it indefinitely and forever, because I could talk about Star Wars for for an unlimited period of time, but I guess that means that we've got to do Empire Strikes Back next, which I am also looking forward to.
Because to me, pumped.
Like, I love New Hope. I love Empire Strikes Back. And the only reason Empire Strikes Back isn't probably one of my favorite movies of all time is because Return of the Jedi I like even more than Empire Strikes Back. So I am very much looking forward to doing the rest of the original series.
Yeah, these next two movies, I think, are probably my favorite two Star Wars movies of all time. And I'm very excited for it.
And you gotta finish Clone Wars. And once you finish Clone Wars, you have to watch Rebels.
We're in season 4. We're working our way through it.
You're almost there. And the it's seasons so get good. Shorter. Because season so 6 and season 7 are both short seasons. Right. So 5 is gonna be something, man. 5 ends, man. Like, I'm telling you, dude, if I was a kid and season 5 was how I thought the show ended, because they canceled it, right? So, like, yeah. The last episodes of season 5, like, that's the end of the show, right? If I was a kid and that was the end of the show, that would have broken my heart, because it is a tragedy. What I actually have learned about Star Wars is that Star Wars on the whole almost errs on the side of tragedy, right? Like, the good guys end up winning, but it usually comes at tremendous cost.
Yeah.
And it usually comes with the caveat that, like, they haven't won forever. They've just won for now. And think how much it cost them to get this victory.
Yeah.
Right.
For all its optimism, it's often a very dark series. But I think finding the hope in those incredibly dark circumstances is part of the magic of Star Wars. And until next time.
Absolutely. We'll see you guys next time. Bye.